Had discovered, had made revolutionary discoveries at Brevo Abbey in Yorkshire. They discovered remnants or signs of an early blast furnace. And this will change our view of the history of industrial technology, and perhaps also indirectly our view of the Middle Ages. As you will probably know in this country, the term Middle Ages and medieval is usually used as a term of abuse. It means slightly stupid. And there was a lot going on at that time. In fact, the newspapers were even saying, did Henry VIII stamp out the Industrial Revolution by the dissolution of the monasteries? So I thought, that sounds interesting, if true. So I thought I'd contact Dr. Monk, asking whether this is a little bit of exaggeration. He said, yes, this is an exaggeration, but there is an interesting history here, and not many people know about it. Dr. Jerry MacDonald was at the archaeometallurgy department at the University of Bradford. In fact, in many ways, he was the archaeometallurgy department at the University of Bradford. He was there for nearly 20 years. He spent 10 years working particularly at Brevo Abbey. He's a PhD from Aston. He's worked at English Heritage. He is a frequent consultant to the BBC and the media on all kinds of archaeological work. I believe you're on the television next week on BBC One on building a narrowboat connected with the history of the Industrial Revolution. And his discoveries about liquid iron production at Brevo have actually caused a minor revolution within the world of archaeology. So, ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome Dr. Jerry MacDonald.
I'm going to run through, hopefully, covering the evolution of Brevo. What I'll hopefully do is, at the end, is provide this brief overview of how iron technology evolved in this Cistercian Abbey. I think one of the key things I say is that as yet, I'm not aware of how this fits in with the wider evolution in the rest of Europe in Cistercian abbeys. There hasn't been much work done on that. I'm going to start with just by a brief talk about the importance of iron. It's often an underestimated and undervalued archaeological artifact. And also I will give a brief summary, hopefully, of iron technology in a sense, as an overview, and try and highlight some of the key points that we need to be thinking about. I'll then turn to thinking about Brevo and have a quick look at its where it is and then the start of it. And of course, one of the very beginnings of one of the key points to bear in mind with Cistercians is that in their first establishment of their early abbeys. Bearing in mind they had it 1098, I think, that one of the very key messages that they came out with was that they were going to control the waste, i.e. they were going to very border areas and take control of the landscape and adopt it to their needs. And that's very much, as it were, perhaps a publicity angle that they used. And then I'll look at what I would call the first and second monastic phases. I've divided the evolution of ironworking into several phases, and we call them quite sensibly one and two, basically, because I can't think of anything else to call them. And then one of the things I want to drop out to then at the end, because that will take us roughly up to about, sort of, say, 14, 1500, but I just then want to have a little think about how iron industry interacts with the other activities of the abbey. I call that conflict in the chapter house. And then we move to the dissolution. The dissolution is clearly seen very much in its sort of religious context, but actually there is actually an industrial context to that, which I think I'll be able to demonstrate. And then, really, to take it forward, because the ironworks continue after the dissolution, so I'm calling that the Cistercian legacy, which effectively takes us up to Abraham Darby in 1709, the classic sort of start date for the Industrial Revolution. And hopefully, what I'll hopefully demonstrate, that we're not really dealing in revolutions, we're dealing in evolution, rather than revolution. And out of that comes some emerging questions. I should point out that even though these are white monks, they are not, these are Benedictines pretending to be Cistercians. They're actually Benedictine monks, but they're wearing white. It's the only photograph I've got. The one thing about, obviously, the Cistercian order is there's a very clear demarcation between the choir monks and the lay brothers. Because the Cistercian order didn't accept the work of serfs, they didn't allow the sort of serfs to be involved in their organisation, there was this group of lay brothers who were really doing all the graft, whereas the choir monks were doing the holy bit. And therefore, is the technology we're looking at specifically Cistercian, or is it what's actually going on in England at that time? And obviously the Cistercian order evolves over time. Since its founding in 1098, right through, there are some quite dramatic changes in its organisation and how it functions and what it does. And to some extent, it'd be interesting to think about how these are interconnected with the evolution that's going on in the iron technology. So to start with, I just mentioned about the importance of iron. And the first place clearly to turn to is somewhere like the British Museum and McGregor's short series of programmes that are on the BBC Radio 4 for 15 minutes, and The World in 100 Objects. And so if you go to the website, you can actually go and look through different periods, look through different materials, metal. And so clearly, as somebody who's passionate about iron, the clear thing to do is to go and find out when McGregor grasps that first piece of iron that he thinks will tell the world in 100 objects. And you go right back, it's helped to look around about, say, 1000 BC, 800 BC, we're into the Iron Age, you know, where's that piece of iron coming from? And I keep looking, you keep looking. And in fact, you can't to get to that, to 2001, before the first bit of iron in McGregor's History of the World in 100 Objects. And really, it just has to be made of Kalashnikov rifles that have to be made of steel. So that, in a sense, in his view, iron is not an important object in History of the World, which is rather sad. So anyway, we'll give it another go. And first thing to point out is the abundance of iron. These are basically very crude distribution maps. We've got gold, tin down there, copper, and lead, zinc. But iron here is plentiful. And in fact, there's a little few words up there that says excluding bog ore, which is a very sort of strange ore that has been very, very important in antiquity, certainly in the Iron Age and probably in the Saxon period. And in fact, if that was included in that map would just be solid all the way from, as it were, the Scilly Isles right the way up to Shetland, i.e. the iron is abundant all over the place. So even if you pick an area right out here, say this Essex, there's a place called Mucking that was excavated, a Saxon site, and that produced extensive evidence of iron smelting. So the great thing about iron is that it's abundant, it's available. If you control tin, you control tin bronze, limited copper deposits, etc. So it's abundant, so that's really quite one reason it's important. And I'm going to take two examples, and I'm taking two humble examples to try and stress the importance of them. They both relate to the North Atlantic, because I'm quite interested in the Viking and the post-Roman, the Saxon, Viking, early medieval period, as well as the main medieval period. And of course we're familiar with our Viking longships that sail the mighty seas. And effectively, one of the key things that they did would be to sail from these warmer areas where these warm currents come up into these far colder areas. And of course, the thing that's holding that Viking ship together is a simple nail. And unless that nail performs correctly and doesn't sort of become, say, brittle in those colder waters, then the ship will perform well. So in fact, I regard a big Viking ship as some rather boring bits of wood held together by some really interesting bits of metallurgy. The second one again relates to, in a sense, sort of domestic and agricultural activities, because iron, if you look back in the history of agriculture, to some extent, even the Bronze Age farmer's toolkit that they're harvesting in the Bronze Age is no different to what they're doing in the Neolithic. It's only with the adoption of iron that you see significant changes, for example, butchery marks on cattle. If in the Bronze Age they're often crushing the big bones to get the marrow out. In the Iron Age, you start seeing them being cut, and that is the introduction of iron or steel-edged tools. And so that role of iron in that agriculture is important. And if I introduce you to this, which is the cod, which is incredibly important, There's great debate in the 11th century, well now, about the great expansion of cod fishing that occurs at this time. And this is very important because it relates to modern understanding of things like cod stocks. Are the cods moving because of climate change, etc., or is there an actual dips and ups and downs in cod populations? And of course the environmental archaeologists are very keen on this because they can get funding to look at this, and they talk about, you know, size of cod and look at bones and all sorts of weird things. And of course they completely miss the key to it, which is this, the simple fish hook. The ability to make iron of a good enough quality that can be thinned down and made as fish hooks in their tens of thousands, their hundreds of thousands. And maybe the reason the expansion happened was because that technology was cracked. That's a bit hypothetical, but it's based on some good research as well. So that's the importance of iron. And if we're looking at somewhere like Revo, the very construction of that abbey could not have happened without iron edge and steel edge tools. So in order to talk about iron making and iron use, think of the classic loomery process. And just to explain what this is, this is what is, as it were, if you open a standard textbook, say Ronnie Talcott's books, which are sort of regarded as very great textbooks on the history of iron, it's a solid state process. The reason for that is that if you're smelting tin ore or copper ore, then tin melts at 232 degrees Celsius, copper at 1084, so that when you smelt it in a furnace, out comes liquid metal. Iron is different because it melts at 1500 degrees Celsius. So if you put iron ore into a furnace, you can't get those temperatures up to melt it as pure iron. And what you want is malleable iron. So you want iron that is low in alloying elements, you don't want too much of other elements in it, so you need it pure. So it was done as a solid state. So the iron would enter the furnace as an iron ore, it would slowly be reduced to metallic iron, and that would fuse as a lump and weld together until you get this massive lump called a bloom that comes out at the furnace. So it's without a liquid phase. And that's what we're going to go into this short presentation with that understanding at the moment. That lump requires refining and working. So this is another process. You take that lump out, you can't hit it, because if you hit it too hard, it will just fracture. It's got to be sort of kneaded and moulded, and not moulded in terms of casting, worked together to clean it up, to get rid of all the bits of slag that are left in it, and consolidate it, and that becomes this nice billet. And then we work in a smithy to convert that billet to bar, and then ultimately to artifact. So those are the three clear stages of iron working to produce, to go from the iron ore to a finished artifact. And we can look at that in a sort of a flow diagram in a sense. So we start off with iron smelting. Up at the top here, go to a furnace, such as this that we built up down in West Sussex in September as part of the conference. So you feed the iron ore and the charcoal in at the top, you blow in lots of air at the bottom, and hopefully that lump of iron forms as a lump which then can be extracted from the bottom. That then bloom is then refined into this billet, and you'll end up then with some bars. Now those might be quite small bars or big bars. In this case, this is a section, this is an Iron Age cart or chariot that was excavated at Ferry Fryston, just off the M62, M1. So the tyre to that cartwheel is made of iron, and it's actually made up a whole series of bars, and it's probably about a metre and a half length of iron in there, and that was dated to, I think, sort of 300 BC, something like that, so that's Iron Age. That's a lot of metals used to make a cart tyre. You then take those bars into a blacksmith's forge and convert them into a useful tool such as a knife, etc. So these are the separate stages of the iron working process. Potentially they can occur all in one place, or they can occur in different places in the landscape, and we'll have a brief look at that as well. So where do they do the iron smelting? Now if you look across sort of the span, as it were, of the archaeological record, we can find it happening within settlements. Not often, but certainly within some. This is a big rock excavation at Old Skepness in southern Shetland. Ex-colleague of Bradford was excavating, just writing up. You can find them in industrial enclosures. This is a small, about 30 metres square. There are about 10 furnaces operating in that, and just all the slag filled in. So this is just, as it were, an industrial complex, as yet it is undated as yet, that probably could be early medieval. Or as isolated smelting furnaces in the landscape. And this is the sort of thing that I'm dealing with at Revo. So isolated furnaces scattered throughout the landscape. From this, we've sort of started to develop some ideas about modelling the landscape. So that in the first area, which perhaps if we look at Revo would fit into this, where we have iron production in the landscape, producing that metal that goes to the smithy that then is manufactured into artifacts. Or it can be traded away. And one of the key questions that we don't know, but we're almost certain, is that Revo is making a vastly more iron than it requires for its own consumption. So iron is actually a really key product of the landscape. We tend to think of Cistercians as just sheep farmers, basically, earning income, but that's, I would argue, is not the case. The second model is much more where they're importing those bars of iron into a smithy and making artifacts for trade or for consumption. And then the final, smaller model, as it were, is that there is no importing of bar, they're just converting and working artifacts and manufacturing and repairing them, perhaps at a sort of a smithy in a farm or something like that. If you look at any excavated Viking settlement in Iceland, they always have a smithy next to the farmstead, where they're probably doing that sort of thing. So those are the models, but we're probably looking at Revo as this, producing iron, and certainly producing iron for consumption, but also for trade. And in a sense, what we're interested in the landscape, and understanding the landscape and the evolution of the Revo landscape, is where this is happening, who's organising it, and how does it interact with all the other things that are going on. So just to put a quick, brief understanding of how ironworking has changed over time. Basically, starting off down here in the Iron Age, we've got to, as it were, what's happening in Scotland and England and Wales, because in England and Wales we have the Romans popping in and disrupting things. But we have a series of sort of cultural changes as we go through the early medieval to the Viking medieval, where we're particularly interested in, then to the post-med, up until effectively those changes there. And again, if you read the standard sort of textbooks, then we'd argue that there are significant changes in smelting technology. Certainly something happened when the Romans arrived in Britain, but in Scotland the traditional Iron Age iron smelting has probably continued. Then we have some smelting changes at the Viking period, and to some extent the books are very quiet then on what's happening until really we get the introduction of blast furnace, which in England is dated accurately to 1496 in the Weald in Kent. And so up until that point, the standard textbooks would argue that this is all this solid-state bloomery. It is only then the blast furnace introduces liquid iron and cast iron as a product. That is, as it were, very much the traditional standard understanding. In fact, it's even now, it's more complicated than that. We've got a whole series of changes that we're seeing both in smelting technology and in smithing technology, blacksmithing technology. But certainly that date of 1496 in the Weald is still very much fixed in many people's minds. That up until that point, it is all this solid-state process, this bloomery process, variations, but then, 1496, everything changes and we're off. And then obviously in 1709, Abraham Darby comes along and introduces coke into the process, and again, we're off. So it's a whole series of sort of big technological changes and leaps. We're going to try and change that a little bit. So if we go and now move to Revo and think about what's happening there, to put you in the picture of where we are, just up in North Yorkshire, we've got York down here, about 20 miles from the edge of what's there, the North Yorkshire Moor National Park, a place like Whitby and Scarborough on the coast, with Teesside and Middlesbrough up here, and the Pennines over, and we have production. Revo is situated down in this bottom left-hand corner, and we have the market town of Helmsley, in which the castle is going to be constructed, and that is going to be the controlling point. There's a whole series of castles that go across to the castle at Scarborough and come up from York. So there's a sort of network of castles that were introduced by, as it were, the early Norman period. And Revo is just situated about 4 miles away. And the valley we're interested in is this one that runs up. It's called Bilsdale and runs northwards. And so the Yorkshire Moors are these series of north-south valleys. And what's also quite significant for here is that we have a feudal landscape as well. When Walter Lisbeck gave lands to Revo, he held on to a tract of land that ran to the north. So one of the things we want to do in the future is actually look at the iron technology that's going on here to see whether it is different to our monastic iron technology. So just to put Revo in its holdings in a wider context, we've got Revo here, Helms is just down here. It's got a series of granges and land holdings going around the edge of those Yorkshire moors, and also up onto the Tees itself, which is very important for fishing, so not just to fish hooks, but certainly to nets and traps. And all that is feeding the abbey. And of course, by this time of Brian Waite's linking all these together, they've been accumulated over centuries, first few hundred years, going far away from that very early Cistercian idea that everything should be in a day's walk. The idea of the simple Cistercian was that the abbey would be self-sufficient within effectively a day's walk and wouldn't grow too big and therefore keep simple life. And we can look at that again in terms of there's North Yorkshire Moors with Revo Abbey there. But these are all the, as it were, metallurgical holdings. So there's a whole group over here that's a lead holding, so producing lead, because all the monasteries need lead for roofs, they need lead for their stained glass windows, they need lead for fishing weights and other uses. And then again here, in fact, near Bradford, and with Leeds, Kirkstall Abbey, another Cistercian Abbey, and obviously Fountains, another Cistercian Abbey. Large granges that are purely, or allegedly purely, ironworking, and again, Wakefield, really significant ones. So not only, I'm concentrating on the home grange, as it were, of Revo, but they're also bringing in iron from these other places as part of their commercial activities. And again, this is why the dissolution is important, because okay, at the dissolution, even though these ironworks are probably being operated by independent ironmasters, they are still paying, as it were, a rent to these abbeys. So the dissolution breaks this sort of stranglehold, to some extent, that the Cistercians had on many of these ironworking sites. So in terms of control of iron production, then the Cistercians are certainly big players. So if we move and then let's go and look at Revo. This is the southern end of Bilsdale itself. So the valley is running further to the north. We'll have a quick picture of what's happening to the north in a second. And Revo is about 4 miles to the south. But in this valley, there's a Jurassic sequence of rocks, of which critically contains an ironstone bed called the Ellerbeck bed, the so-called Doggerseen of iron, and then the main seam, and that forms at the lower valley end the valley floor. So there are three major seams. The Ellerbeck bed is pretty bitty, really, but this Doggerseen and the main seam are really the crucial players in this industry. And just as an aside, it's got the jet, the famous Whitby jet, also outcrops here, and also in this deposits is the alum that is the start of the chemical industry in the 17th century. So those deposits are available in the Moor side, but the valleys are basically arable, pasture predominantly in the valley floor, rising to heather-clad moorland on some acidic sandstones. But in the medieval period, this was not the picture. That moorland that's up there now is a relatively recent development. It would probably be sort of brushwood and willow and things like that. So still good grazing ground. And then right to the further north, he's still got these two main seams. The Elbeck is probably a bit more continuous. The Dogger is the main one. And the main seam now is probably under a metre or two of say glacial alluvium. So it's still accessible if necessary. So there's about 8 miles of exposure on both sides of the valley of this Dogger seam, and there's about 2 miles of the main seam exposed in the valley floor. So even though the iron ore isn't particularly good quality, and that works to our benefit, because great things about this landscape, that at the end of the blast furnace period in the 17th century, there was no later working of the iron here, unlike other areas that constantly continued on. So we were not, as it were, contaminated by later activity. So other than iron ore, there are other key essential requirements to produce iron. The first is the clays for building the furnaces themselves. So they're predominantly clay-built furnaces, and certainly the insides of the clay, and both within the valley floor and in the exposures on the sides, there are extensive clay deposits. The other thing is woodland fuel. Furnaces consume charcoal. This is our experimental furnace that we constructed at Revo and worked for about on 5 or 6 occasions and let it decay away, so it's now decaying away up there. That would consume probably in something like 100 kilos of charcoal a day. The furnaces that we will be envisaging in the sort of 14th century are probably consuming 200 to 300 kilos a day. The blast furnace at the end is probably consuming 2 tons of charcoal a day. And roughly to produce, this is a whole heap, it's roughly a ratio of 4 to 1. So to produce a ton of charcoal, you need 4 tons of wood. So wooded woodland of the right type is absolutely essential. And the other thing that we require is water power. In a sense, at some periods, is to drive bellows. And of course, water is noted for, well, the Cistercians are noted for their control of water power. And there's a poem of, I think, the 10th century, which describes the flow of water through the abbey precinct, that it grinds the corn, it works other things, it does the tannery, and then it takes away the waste. And this is actually the latrine flow at Revo Abbey. So water was essential to these abbeys. And indeed, at Revo, there's big arguments about whether they diverted the river in order to build the abbey, which is a separate issue. But obviously, they knew their water power. So coming back to this idea of was it waste or was it profitable? Just to run through a little bit of history, which I'm not very good at, we always have the Norman Conquest. Helms in this area is effectively Norman's the king. We have this harrying of the north, northern revolt, and there is great discussion about how extensive was the destruction, as it were. There is some data, for example, prior to the conquest, Helmsley was worth 32 shillings or the manor there, and then 10 shillings, 1086, and some 10 years, 20 years after that harrowing. But it's not worthless. It is not an empty waste. And also bearing in mind that by the time that the monks arrived in 1131, it is now 60 years ago since that harrowing, so it's had time to regenerate. Helmsley is given to Walter Espec, one of William's key players. They start to build castles, and then the first thing he does, he gives some land to a place called Kirkham Priory, which is about 20 miles away to the southeast near Malta. And then at 1131 is the foundation of Revo. That's the first Cistercian abbey in the north. Kirkham's in Cistercian, and it's a direct daughter of Clairvaux Abbey. And what he did was, there's Walter Espec sitting at Helmsley Castle. One of the first things to notice in the early documents, the first grant, is that the Magna Via whichever it is next to, is the main road, and this runs along the moor top. So the main communications were along the tops of the moors. And in a sense, everything we're looking at is in the valley floor, and I think this is, again, is another change that Cistercians bring to it. They do alter the landscape. But importantly, the very first grant in 1131 is only this small area here around Revo itself. And this is only in 1145 that they give the grant, the second grant, which actually incorporates all the iron ore. So for the first sort of 14 years of their building of that first abbey, they have no access at all to iron ore. They must have been buying it in. Now, presumably Walter Speck is holding this, so if there's iron working going on there, which I'm sure there is, he would either be selling it to them or supplying it to them. So the Cistercians only really enter into ironworking technology in 1145, when they take over this great tract of land that runs north. And then right at the top, this is what I call the blocking grant, that he gives this little bit of land here to Kirkcaldy. And that stops Revo having direct access to the Tees Valley up here. So if they're wanting to ship their iron out, they can't really go this way. They've got to come back down this way and out, because they have a place called Spotsdam as well. So this is a little intrigue as to why the spec gave Kirkham that, but it does seem to close off access for the Revo lands and Lay brothers to access directly out of the Yorkshire Moors, because that's really drops off rapidly then when you're into the Tees Valley. So that's a little bit about sort of the geography and the early history. So what we'll do is just look at this first, what we call the first monastic phase of what's happening historically within this first phase. So we've got the founding of Revo, which we could put in here 1145 when they take over the iron ore field, as it were. We have in 1145 there, 1138 is something called the Battle of Stanley in Northallerton, and England won that match. And of course, 47 to 67 is when Abbot Aylward, the famous Abbot Aylward, takes over at Revo, and by when his death, there are some 640 monks and lay brothers there. And to some extent, in that first 100 years and a bit, it's virtually a building site, because they build the first monastery, abbey, and then he comes along and they say, no, we're going to build it bigger and better, and it's rebuilt and reorganised. So it's virtually a building site all the way through. So again, the need for iron for the masons, for the carpenters, for everybody who's involved in the construction of that abbey would have been absolutely essential. Not all was good news. 1276, a thing called the Great Moraine, which was a disease that affects the sheep. And they effectively went bankrupt, and several times that Revo went bankrupt. And then in 1280, this is all coming from sort of the general history and the cartooneries, to some extent. The only mention in the cartooneries, and that's the sort of the legal documents of grants and etc. For the abbey that can be vaguely related to ironworking. Is this 1280, a lawsuit over the theft of Kirkham timber? I probably to that block of blocking land to the north of Billsdale, they were obviously snitching some timber. And that, other than that, the cartoonery is completely silent about ironworking at Revo. There are later grants and things when they get these grants of these granges over in West Yorkshire and things like that, and they mention specifically it's there to dig ore, mine ore, and smelt iron, etc. But within their home territory, there's absolutely no mention at all in cartoonery. So it either means two things, either that it was just common activity, or that it was so minor that it was not significant. And I dispute the latter. There is one document in 1301, I think, called the Lay Subsidy. Bear in mind, I'm no historian, that has basically a super tax that goes out, so there's actually some detail in that about people who are living in Billsdale at the time. And then critically in 1322, the Scots, and certainly contained my ancestors, came down at the Battle of Byland, and Billsdale and the Hamiltons were laid bare. Revo and Byland, its near neighbour, are sacked, and obviously the king is nearly captured and uses all his treasure, etc. And clearly that happens to have a major impact. We could have also inserted in there, I think in, I can't remember the exact date, but it's a bit earlier than that, maybe 1339, there's a thing called the Great Famine that struck parts of Northern Europe, and in some cases there was allegedly more people died in that than did the later Black Death. So that's basically boxing in, which I call the first monastic phase. And there's a reason for that, is because the dates we are getting for our furnaces seem to end around about here. And so it is this piece of activity that I suspect might have been the blow that really finished everything off. So we then move into what I call the second monastic phase, and really, as we've seen, this is a little bit of a sort of an unseen phase. The only things that initially obviously worth mentioning is things like the Black Death. Now, if you've got this decimation of the population, then to some extent, does your iron consumption drop accordingly as well? Also in this period, this is when the Cistercian estate is changing how it's operated. Up until this time, everything is run directly, as it were, from the abbey itself, from that chapter house. Now they start to put things out to tenancies, and so it's a slightly different organisation and relationship. So again, are things changing in terms of technology? And then I draw a line at 1500 because it's got two zeros in it and there can't be anything particular that happened. It seems like a good date to end the second monastic phase. It could be 1400, it could be 1420, I don't know. I don't think it's much later than 1500 for various reasons, but I've got no absolute date, so I've just picked a number at that point. So those are the first two monastic phases. And then we move into what I call the dissolution phase, which obviously focuses around 1538. And I've stretched it a little bit beyond that because the furnaces that are mentioned in the dissolution phase cease working in about 1575. And then, to all intents and purposes, we're into what would be called the blast furnace phase. Because now, again, we've got documents, although they haven't been researched because they're not very accessible, we've got some data. So to the extent that in 1591-2, we've actually got the detailed daily output of what's coming out of the furnace. Then, of course, we have the Civil War. And that 1647 is the last documentary reference to Revo, to the blast furnace. And several things to think about, that clearly within that Civil War, control of the production of cast iron would have been a major concern to those two forces. Because if you're throwing cannonballs at each other, you need to be able to control who's producing the cast iron. So that's the sort of in a sense four phases, two monastic phases, the dissolution and then the blast furnace. So if you look through what's happening in the first monastic phase, so this is from 1145 to about 1320. What we're envisaging is that we through field walking and various other activities, we've identified a series of small iron smelting sites, such as this one. This is just basically a slab, pile of slag in a field. And we've identified a whole series in the valley. And then what we conducted geophysical surveys over them. This is a magnetic survey, which enables us to identify specific features. In this case, the ore roasting is where they roasted the ore. You dig the ore out of the ground, you need to roast it to improve it. Then the actual furnace itself is detected. And with this one, this is Stingemeyer's. We're very lucky because at this point here, in this disturbed area, we were lucky enough because the furnace is actually built into the natural sloping up ground level. So the shaft is effectively dug into the ground and the furnace comes up from that. So this is just the very bottom bit. But this one survived to about 90 centimetres in height. Most of the time we're only getting 60 centimetres, and luckily with this one we actually have the blowhole that survived. And that's much bigger than we expected. And we'll come back to that shortly. So what we envisage doing, is happening in this period, is that a furnace is constructed, it's operated, pops intensely for sort of 2 or 3 months of the year, it utilises the local woodland, the ore source is continuous, as it were, Then in the next year, they moved to a new site. The following year, to another site. Ran down the valley, and then finally, probably after about 20 years, they're back to the original site, or near to the original site. The reason 20 years is important is because if you're doing coppicing, then things like alder, which is one of the dominant forms, will have regenerated by that time. So effectively, in terms of impact on the landscape, there isn't any. And we've done, at a PhD student, doing the pollen analysis of that, and you cannot see the impact of the ironworking. You cannot see the arrival of the monks, i.e. because they've effectively got a managed landscape. So there's no great impact. It's a managed, controlled landscape. So from those products, we have the slag itself, which is the waste product, and the metal itself. And I'll just say something very briefly about the slag, because I like the numbers anyway. But there's a degree of consistency, and indeed when we've excavated five of these furnaces, and when you do, quite honestly, they have been built by the same person. They are so alike. These are using a really well-understood, well-controlled furnace technology. And the slag composition, first to note that this is the iron oxide, there's an awful lot of iron left in these slags. It's not, in terms of that person, very efficient. But it's the best you can get for this technology. There's one site here called Tarn Hole that actually stands out. If you look at the lime content and the aluminium content, it's different, but it's also physically different. Somebody else also excavated it, and that's not an issue, but it's physically in a different place in the landscape, and I think it's either a different group, and the dating's a little bit doubtful. So we're starting to build a degree of knowledge. But there is some variation, so they're not doing everything exactly the same. Perhaps we could understand that if they are moving and the ore quality varies as they move around the valley. What also comes out from the metal is that we're consistently finding that, in theory, if this is the bloomery process, this solid state process, then the iron bits that we should find should just be iron, but we're not finding that. We're finding these structures which have got a lot of carbon in them, up to about 1%, 1.5%. Now that, in effect, in some regions, sort of virtually cast iron, which is about 4%, which really means that they're really pushing these furnaces and they're operating effectively, and this is why I believe that they're not producing this solid state lump of pure metal about iron, they're producing liquid cast iron coming out of these furnaces. So this furnace was originally one that we built on the sort of the internal diameter of the ones that we'd excavated, but and the height there of about 1.20 meters was carefully worked out because that's when we ran out of clay. Other than that, internally it should be about right. But from the excavations and thinking about things and the knowledge we're gaining, first of all, we think the actual archaeological furnaces are not 1.20 meters high, they're 3 meters. Bearing in mind, 1 meter is built into the ground, or 90 centimeters, so there's 2 meters standing above. So they're much, much bigger than we've previously thought. Secondly, that around them is constructed a column. And by a column, means sort of rubble, timber, and acting as support and insulation. So we've got 90 centimeters into the ground, and then another meter with a collar around the furnace. So effectively what's sticking out of that collar is the last meter that's sticking up. And also, we're now convinced, because of that size, that blow hole, and other factors, that we're producing with water powers. So that means we're actually dealing not with a small 1.5 meter furnace, but something that's 3 meters high and is driven by bellows, water powered bellows. Whereas the bloomery process assumes you've got hand powered bellows and foot powered bellows. So it's tall, it's water powered, it's producing high carbon iron, probably cast iron, and in fact the slags are actually very low. They can't get any better, you can't get any more iron out of that ore using these technologies. So is it a blast furnace? Well, some people might say it is because it might be producing cast iron. But we're sticking with a sort of an intermediate term, a sort of high bloomery. But it's a proto-blast furnace on the way to being a blast furnace. And so what we're saying is that now, that date of 1496, which was the introduction of the blast furnace and cast iron into the Wealden Kent, is in error. And we're seeing liquid iron being produced in the 13th and 14th centuries at Revo and probably elsewhere. So that ends the first monastic phase. And so after that devastation by the Scots, because the reason is we've got archaeomagnetic dates for those furnaces, and they all seem to be ending about there. In the second monastic phase, what happens, we see just two sites. This one called the Grange, and this one at Lasskill. And I can't say much about this phase, because we haven't really done much excavation. So this is the slide of this Grange site up here, and this is the geophysics. So the photograph is taken from here, looking out that way, and this is completely different. We've got structures, we've still got massive amounts of slag, and it's a completely different, it's quite an intense place that's in operation. So we think that this is something totally different compared to the other sites, and this is one we've targeted for the work. So bear in mind, I can't say much about this second monastic phase because effectively it's hidden at the moment. I want to return back to those early days, perhaps, and think about what's happening in the Chapter House in those sort of first 100 years or so, where all the, as it were, agreements are coming through. And utilising my three children, get dragged to these sites, what I would envisage is there's a monk in charge of the sheep, for which the Cistercians are well known, and what they want is open pasture. They want lots of open pasture for grazing, because they can make money out of the wool. The monk in charge of the arable, who's got to feed maybe these 600 monks that are now at lay brothers, who are predominantly living off the vegetarian diet, needs lands to plough and grow beans and crops. And so they want fields and ploughing. Whereas the monk in charge of the iron wants areas to be mined and woodland. So there are these three monks I can visit continually arguing and saying we are more important than the other because of these different things. So even though, to some extent, the technology is slightly distant from as it were, what's happening in the abbey itself, that actually the politics of whether, why didn't they just, for example, just rely on their ironworks over in West Yorkshire? Why did they continue with their local iron production? So it's those three conflicting pressures on the landscape that evolve that landscape today. So moving on now to the dissolution phase, so we're moving into effectively 1538. And now what's happened again is everything has moved south again. Effectively we started off all up here, we then moved to the Grange and Lasskill. Now we've got Lasskill and the Hammersmithy at Revo. And we were lucky because we've got some really good documents now. This is the first time we've got details of what happened. We've got the inventory by the Earl of Rutland, as it were, before he takes it over. There's a survey and some ministers' accounts. And that was discussed by those were discussed by Copac in that publication. And there's lots of really quite significant detail in there, and in fact that a lot of this is actually published in H.R. Schubert's History of the Bishan and Steel Industry, published in about 1956, I think. And the Earl shall bear all the rents and the smiths, the Earl shall repair the said smithies and the housing and the hearth, the chimneys and the wheels and the waterworks. And there's all sorts of lots of lovely detail in there that we're still considering. So we know an awful lot about it. And it tells us that it's got its bloomsmithy at Lasskill and its hammersmithy at Revo, and actually physically states their name. So that's the first time we can actually nail those down. And if we go now quickly look at Timberholme, again, on the geophysics, it is completely different. The river is running down here. We've got a big leat that is bringing the water power in to here. We've got a slag heap, a noisy slag heap here. But here, we've got furnace structure. If you look at that in detail, it's now square. And we also did earth resistance, which means it's made of stone. So now we've moved away from a clay-built structure to a stone-built structure that is more akin, as it were, to what most people, and also it's 5 metres square. So now we're much bigger. It's got the same footprint as an early classic blast furnace, if you look at those. And again, when we look at the slag, that's, as it were, the mean of the average of the monastic ones. I mean, just look at the iron content, the ones that think that's a little high actually for one reason, but it's most of them are more of this low end of the 30 to 35% iron oxide. But when you get to Las Hill, this site, it's dropped right down to 5, and when you look at the blast furnace slag from Revo, it's right down to 4. I.e., the whole technology has improved another step. So that is there probably by 1500, if not earlier, and is effectively, for all intents and purposes, a blast furnace. It's stone built, it's water powered, and it's producing cast iron. So just to sort of draw to an end, we've dealt with the dissolution, so it could that person has, but what is the legacy? How is this taken forward? Even at the dissolution, that ironworks is operated by an independent operator, a guy called Lambert Seamer, and he runs the ironworks. So he was effectively operating the ironworks and paying rent to the months after the dissolution. He just pays rent to the Earl of Rutland. So we've got the Civil War and then that last reference. And just to say a little bit, and now again, we've moved south yet again. We've abandoned that site at Timberhome and Maskill. We've moved south yet. The ore, of course, is still up here. And my supposition for this continuous move southward is the increasing need for fuel. There's far more woodland down here than there is up there. And now this blast furnace, we have the classic sequence of things that you require. You have a blast furnace that converts the iron oxide, the ore, to cast iron. You have a finery which refines this cast iron into a malleable iron, and a chafery which converts this block of malleable iron into bar that can be traded out. And this is Revo from the air. We found where they were roasting ore. We found their water supply. And we've also excavated in this building, which I have interpreted as charcoal store. So we have lots of water power coming in at this point. We have the charcoal store. We have ore roasting. We have the ore store. The slag heap here. So in a sense, the blast furnace, where it would have been, was under that house, and obviously we'll never see it again, so quite safe in that interpretation. But it's interesting that they've reutilised the monastic building as the old, this was the rectory building, as the charcoal store. So there's the blast furnace. Further down was the finery, and this was the hammersmithy that was referred to in the dissolution. So even in the latter period of the abbey, even though there's only probably half a dozen monks in the abbey, there was a forge working there within about 150 metres. So not quite the quiet, contemplative lifestyle with a massive water-powered forge pounding away day and night. And then this chafery. So they have a complete sequence. And then the bar iron would then be traded out. Just to put a different picture on it, those early bloomery process, first direct processes would have produced blooms perhaps of tens of kilos. Our furnaces that I'm thinking of are probably producing hundreds of kilos today. The blast furnace in 1592 is effectively producing a ton of cast iron a day. So that's the scale that has moved up in those few hundred years. And most of it just goes to the conversion to malleable iron, because that's what the blacksmiths want. Very few, only 4%, is made into cast products. And all those cast products are related to bits of the furnace. They're either plates for the furnace or something else for the furnace. They're not actual anything else. So what happens following that this is the number of blast furnaces in England through the period, coming from around 1500 and increasing. And this is according to one author. A couple of things to point out in a minute. First of all, this yellow line marks the work of Dud Dudley in 1609, who actually first experimented using coal and coke in blast furnaces 100 years before Derby did. So again, this emphasises that this is evolution and perhaps not revolution. This is when Revo closed, and now you can see that the number of blast furnaces are declining, in a sense. This is Derby in 1709, and they're still declining, declining, declining. And it is only in 1780 when the Iron Bridge at Iron Bridge Course is constructed, and effectively the properties of cast iron are recognised, and they start to use it properly. All along this period, most of this iron that's being produced has been converted back into this malleable iron. So they're doing the same thing that the monks were doing effectively towards the end, or certainly from the 1300s onwards, but it's just on a bigger scale. So that's all that's changed, is the scale of activity. So to conclude, what is that legacy? Within the very structure of that, the wonderful structure that is Rivo Abbey and Fountains Abbey and Roach Abbey and all the other Cistercian abbeys and all the other abbeys, is that first of all, iron is integral to the very construction of that abbey. It requires the mason's tools, the forester's tools, to construct the very buildings that they're utilising. So it's absolutely running tens of thousands of sheep. They need clipper shears to clip the sheep, so they need iron for that. But quite clearly, the number of furnaces they've got, both operating both in the home grange here, but in coming from West Yorkshire, they're producing far in excess than their own needs, so they're producing this as a profitable commodity of their effectively very efficient estates. And then, obviously, as that's Rivo at its most magnificent, really, at the end of Aylward's. There's a few little bits here that are built later, but to some extent, that's mostly Aylward's construction. That, in a sense, is in a steady state of decline, but iron production keeps going. And in a sense, Rivo still plays its part in that iron technology because it has brought on this liquid technology. It comes back to Rivo in the classic form of the blast furnace, and then finally loses out, probably in the Civil War, when the quality of iron here just isn't meeting the requirements and competition both in places like the Weald and Kent. So the Cistercians, I think, had a really critical key role in this technology that leads from the sort of 10th, 11th centuries, 12th centuries, right through to effectively the evolution of the classic blast furnace and everything that went on from that. Thank you.